The big business story of the year, what else? The rise of AI, artificial intelligence. But it's not just a business story. It is also making big waves in education. And it's changing not only how students learn, but how they work. Maybe how they cheat.
It's only a machine. It's called artificial intelligence, but it's not that intelligent.
ChatGPT is forcing educators to rethink the way they teach and the way they test students.
ChatGPT forces us to think about what it is that we do, why we do it, and how we can do it better.
We've heard about assessment and cheating, but I'm also kind of interested in seeing how you could embed it in some way so that the learning experience for the students is improved.
It's actually very scary. It is basically cheating, like an app is doing your work for you. It's not like your own work.
Students for whom English is not their first language say they have to work twice as hard for their grades, and they're angry at the prospect of others getting a free ride.
For me, there's a taint of hypocrisy as well. You can't seriously ask me to believe that academics, administrators, these people, those people, aren't also using those tools.
They're going to use it. In fact, I know of a student at a Ivy League university who got response from the professor, this is the best essay that I've ever seen, and that student confided that it was written by ChatGPT.
AI, it's here, it's now. But did anyone actually ask for it? And how will it affect how we teach and how we learn? Hello, and welcome to The Secret Life of Language, a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hajek, and in my day job, I'm a linguist and I'm also the head of the school.
And I'm Dr. Yu Hao. I do teaching and research in the field of translation studies. And I'm also a professional translator. Thanks for joining us on the first of a series of episodes that we hope will throw some light on how generative AI is impacting teaching and research activities in university settings.
In this series, we'll be featuring conversations we've been having with experts in policy and ethics, in curriculum design and assessment, and in the very generative AI technologies that, whether we like it or not, are driving change into almost every aspect of tertiary education.
Given our own backgrounds in languages and linguistics, we'll be devoting a bit of extra time to looking at how generative AI is making itself felt in our areas, like language teaching, translation, and the preservation of minority languages.
There'll also be a third host you'll be hearing on the series. Eric Van Bemmel is one of our producers for the podcast, and he's also agreed to be our AI guinea pig. Eric, what does that entail?
Well, it means that while I'll be taking part in the conversation, I'll be making use of generative AI technologies.
So that I can sound like a totally different person.
No matter whether it's a man or a woman.
Or I might want to sound like
I come from a completely different country.
I mean, as you can tell there, generated voices don't sound robotic anymore. Plus, you can take the spoken intonation, the emotional tone from a real person and layer that onto a very convincing voice clone, all with the help of generative AI. We'll be experimenting more with that in later episodes. We started work on this series some months back when products like OpenAI's ChatGPT had already made their initial splash on the larger public consciousness and in our workplaces.
And while we know these products themselves have gone from strength to strength, and actually only continue to do so, we found in our many conversations with colleagues and other experts that what remains a constant for everyone is questions and concerns around different things like the degree to which generative AI is being imposed on us. Do we really have to use it? Getting to grips with the practical use of the technologies. How do I use this stuff? what to embrace and what to be leery of, what does hallucination mean, and the upending, for better or worse, of the long-cherished, tried-and-true ways of teaching and learning at the university.
Perhaps more than that, generative AI poses serious challenges around what meaning or value we should now be assigning to that thing we call a university education. We want to kick off the series with a conversation we had with a professor of law who spent a lot of time thinking about artificial intelligence in this space.
Professor Jeannie Patterson is from the Melbourne Law School, but she's also director of the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics, a collaborative centre that draws on the expertise of the law, engineering, medicine, education and arts faculties here at the University of Melbourne. Jeannie's own specialty is consumer protection law and digital ethics, and she's spent the last decade researching the intersection between AI and related technologies and what they mean for protections of fairness, bias, privacy and existential risk. We started by asking her about the ethics and policy challenges that generative AI is bringing to the university setting.
The emergence of generative AI in university setting has disrupted all of our assumptions about what we do, I think. I think it's an existential challenge for universities, but it's also a very practical challenge for universities. Some people call this plagiarising when they use generative AI to create work. It's not plagiarising. That's not how generative AI works. It doesn't go out and copy stuff and plonk it down. It reassembles material. But I think it's probably collusion because students aren't, on one view, doing their own work. So we want integrity in assessment. And I've talked to philosophers who say, you know, actually the process of putting pen to paper and writing or typing answers is how we know that students are engaging with the material, developing their thinking skills. So the idea that you can outsource that thinking to something else is a real challenge to what we do in universities. But equally, generative AI is throughout the world. It's everywhere. It's in every workplace. We can't ignore that it's present. And in some cases, it can be really useful to students. I personally am dyslexic, so that means that I find seeing spelling errors problematic, hard. I don't see misspelt words. That's not the way dyslexic people see words. So anything that checks my language, but also checks for missing words, which is something else I do, is really useful to me. And is using AI to check my spelling and also missing words collusion? I don't think so. But somewhere there's a line between this is not my own work and I've used a tool to improve and polish my work. And universities, I think, are still grappling with how we draw those distinctions and where we sit and how we think about assessment to make it still meaningful and how we think about the use of technology to improve students' learning experience and perhaps also make participation in universities more equitable and accessible for people who have issues with language or text or whatever.
I actually have a follow-up question about using ChatGPT or other kinds of generative AI in assessment. So I've been sitting on the Student Integrity Committee. So in that committee, we normally have the hearings in which the students who sometimes committed to misconduct, for example, using ChatGPT in one of their assignments. So we normally have hearings, have students coming in, and we have academic representatives, so I'm one of them. We've seen growing cases of students that is using ChatGPT in their drafting or fine-tuning or checking grammar in their assessment, and it's normally not allowed. So I'm wondering where is the boundary? Because some of the students, they have the arguments like, oh, we're second language speakers. Sometimes it's quite useful to use the ChatGPT for grammar checking or finding synonyms for specific words or just checking whether their writing conform to academic English, the specific style. So whether that is allowed.
So the question of the use of generative AI in universities is just multi-layered. There's the question of what is our role, and then there's the question of what do we think is right and proper, and how do we define and explain that to students and indeed to staff. Now, at the moment, the rule is you shouldn't use generative AI in your work
If you do, you need to disclose it. You should be disclosing what tools you use. So if I chose to use Grammarly to check my work, if I was sending that to an academic publisher, I should be disclosing it. And if I was using it in an assignment, I should be disclosing it. If I was using another tool, I should be disclosing it. But some lecturers can also set down a rule that says, do not use any AI tools in completing your work, which now rules out Grammarly, which is interesting because not so long ago we were suggesting to students that they use Grammarly to check their spelling and their punctuation. Well, now we're saying, I think that's an AI, so that needs to be disclosed and can be precluded. So for students, the fundamental rule is disclose and also check with your lecturer to see if your lecturer themselves has decided that the tools should not be used. The world is still grey for students because we let them use a spell check, but anything else we're saying, well, you need to disclose it and maybe you can't use it. And I don't think as yet as a university we've worked out how we think AI is useful for students and how we think it oversteps the bounds of producing work that has the integrity that we want it to have for assessed piece.
I mean, I've got a couple of things to say in response to that. I mean, you know, Grammarly crops up quite a lot and that's obviously promoted itself quite successfully around the world. Ads keep popping up in your YouTube feed, etc., about the wonders of Grammarly. I don't think people necessarily understand it's AI because it was there before AI became a thing. So they don't necessarily associate it with it. They just think this is something that's helping me with my style and grammar and spelling. But that in itself is being superseded now at a lower level because Microsoft and various other softwares, you know, they're providing similar services now. They will provide you with bits of text. Can you reword this way, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to say, it's not, you know, having a look at all of these things, it's not necessarily the case that the text is better than the original. It may actually not understand what the original was. It's always the problem with AI. You know, statistically, this is what I think it might mean, and this is how I think it can be rewritten. But of course, that's not necessarily the case. So it does potentially add errors. And what it does really well is basic things like checking your simple grammar, not necessarily sentence structure, checking spelling, etc., and replacing, you know, odd expressions. But now it's seeping right into Word and other things. There's no boundary anymore. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Disclose that I wrote this with Microsoft Word?
I know. That's the point. The technology is changing faster almost than universities' policies can keep up with. And go back to the point about we don't know where the AI sits. One of the most important aspects of AI ethics or AI governance or responsible AI is that transparency piece so that people know what they're dealing with. Where I think we start to run into challenges with academic integrity or the integrity of academic work or research is where you're, for example, using what's called a RAG, where you plug in a set of documents.
That's retrieval augmented.
Thank you.
Generation.
Retrieval augmented generation.
It's a plug-in. It's not part of the model. It actually works with the large language model to go out and grab information to fill in the gaps. And that's why things like ChatGPT will say, all the information goes up until, you know, 6 months ago, and they'll update that every so often. But if you ask it about something that's going on today, it has not been trained on the data.
Yep.
Whereas if you have a RAG, you can actually go out and grab the stuff on what's happening with the U.S. presidential campaign, for example, today.
Or your reading guide.
Exactly.
Up until recently, we've gone, well, you know, ChatGPT is not so great on Australian content. It's not so great on recent content. It's best on American content. But if you can use a RAG, basically plug in a set of relevant materials or even yourself just as simply as upload a PDF, then all of a sudden the power of the ChatGPT is now being directed at particular resources, which is going to improve the relevance of the material, even though you'll still have the problem with hallucination because the way generative AI works is it doesn't understand truth. It's producing language. But you're narrowing down the scope of that error if you can use a RAG or if you can upload documents and say, I want my answer to come from this. And once we move to that creating content as opposed to checking language side of generative AI, to me, that's where the challenge to academia is, not in the, oh, somebody used a Grammarly or a Microsoft tool to check their language. It's where, and I understand there's a fine line in writing, but when you're actually retrieving the material and using that AI to to produce the substantive content, and then maybe saying through some very clever prompting, I want my first paragraph to say this, and I want my second paragraph to say this, and I want my third paragraph to say this. That's, I think, where we're really straying into the land of what academics might call collusion, but in the business world, we call efficient.
Mm. It's a productivity measure.
Yeah.
But the problem is you don't know who's done it. I mean, that, and that becomes the issue, particularly in assessment, because precisely as you say, you know, was it the machine or was it the human? And how do you know there's actually been any learning?
That's right. That's exactly right. If we say that what we're training people to do is not to replicate the work that they would do in the business world or in government, but actually learn material, learn, think deeply about material, whether it's coding, thinking about language or thinking about law, the thinking deeply thing is the thing we want to do, I think, as scholars, thinking deeply and using specific specialised knowledges. We start to become very worried about that when we think about the uses of generative AI to both retrieve and create the outputs. That's more than polishing. That's somewhere where that line is of where we say this is unacceptable collusion and this is acceptable polishing. And that's quite a sophisticated debate, and it probably differs across different specialities. So it's not an easy answer. You know, if we're just dealing at it at academic misconduct committees, that's way too late. My concern about dealing with AI at the misconduct level is this as well. I don't think students know always what they're using. That's your point.
Yep.
And my other point is sometimes students are accused of using AI, and we're seeing this a lot in the media, where students say, I didn't. And often the detection of AI use in a piece of written assessment comes from thinking that language is odd. The paragraphs are unconnected. There's a certain pattern in the language. Now, sometimes that's because a student has substantively used an AI tool, a ChatGPT, and sometimes that's because students are in a hurry and write badly. I mean, a lot of students do their assessment the night before.
But if I can address those kinds of things, I'll give you a couple of examples. So I was teaching a course and I had an essay to correct, and the essay was perfectly grammatically correct in English, but something didn't sound right. It didn't seem to hit the mark, and I didn't know what it was. There was something about the meaning that wasn't quite right. And so I translated it back using software into Chinese, and I showed it to one of our tutors who was a native speaker of Chinese. All of a sudden, the meaning made complete sense. It was completely grammatical in both languages, using special characters, refined intellectual characters in the Chinese, but the meaning was spot on in the Chinese, and now it all made sense. And she could compare the two texts. She was a native speaker of Chinese, and say, actually, this is really, really good text in terms of what it's trying to express. Now, what do we do in that particular case? You know, the student has handed to us a text in English, but what do you do in those cases when you don't have the skills to work backwards?
I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to say you give the student the benefit of the doubt.
And now, they may say, I wrote the piece in Chinese, and I acknowledge that, you know, it is a translated document. Does that make a difference?
If they used a translation tool, that should be disclosed. Do we think a translation tool is collusion, plagiarism, or not their own work?
Well, they're told in the Faculty of Arts that they should not be using translation software when they're submitting work. That's got to be their own words. But their argument is, but I did write it. I just wrote it in another language and it's now being translated. I don't know whether you've had any examples of that at the committee.
I actually do. So lots of international students, sometimes they just admitted in one of those hearings saying, oh, I did use machine translation, but that was my ideas. So was that a case of misconduct or?
And this is why this is quite specific. So the first thing is the student needs to disclose the tools they use, and they need to check the rules that are imposed by the individual faculty or lecturers. So if the faculty says don't use a translation tool, then the students shouldn't actually be using translation tools. But that's not the same as saying to someone, you used AI to write this. And my comment would be that we sometimes say students must have used AI to write this assignment because the assignment is odd. Now, that's an argument for marking the assignment down, but I'm not sure that's a case for bringing misconduct. I'm concerned about the individual student who is in a poor position to defend that claim of misconduct. Now, that's a terrible position to be for a university to be in, because, of course, students should produce their own work. And any student that uses any, whether it's someone else to write their assignment or an expert parent or a generative AI tool, is cheating. They're gaining an advantage over another student who's producing their own work. So, of course, that's morally wrong, as well as against the rules of the university. But the problem for us, I think, as a university now is it's very difficult for us to distinguish between a student who's written badly and then used a Grammarly tool to polish their writing so that it's accurate English but conceptually poor, a student who's written the work and used a translation tool, and a student that's created their work substantively using an AI tool. Now, all of those, I think, are ethically different, and I think in terms of academic misconduct, they're different, but it's very difficult for us at the university to distinguish between those things. At the moment, we're asking students to disclose and also to follow particular rules that faculties will lay down. And that's a difficult situation too, because the more complex we make the rules, the harder they are to follow. But also we've kind of got no way of following through with those rules. That's the dilemma for us. I don't have the answer. I just am recognising I think it's a lot harder than perhaps some of us are realising.
Oh, no, I agree totally. And there are other issues that have arisen. And one of them is, so, you know, just to go back a few years, the universities tightened up their policies around plagiarism and, you know, academic integrity, et cetera, and actually become much tighter in the last few years. Now, that was just before AI hits. All of a sudden, they're stuck with literally exponential growth in the number of students who are being reported, because we're told if you have any suspicions, you must report this. Now, previously, before the explosion of AI, what we found ourselves in, you know, I don't know you if you've had this experience, we report this and then months and months and months and months and months go past. We do not hear a word. And then we discover, even though we're fairly confident that, you know, this has been unethical behavior, we discover that the student is given the benefit of the doubt. And we are told, without any discussion, that you must allow the student to resubmit the piece of work by December the 20th. So there goes your Christmas holidays, etc. Now, that was before AI. So it was already a problem. And, you know, AI comes in. Now, all of a sudden, we have a massive explosion in each faculty, like literally from 50 to 900 cases. The backlog is so great that they're actually now sending them back to the original complainants, the coordinators, and saying, you deal with this, and an educated response is probably the best response in the first instance. So it's all come back to the coordinators in most cases, who are dealing with hundreds of these things. With the doubts that you say, look, you can't be sure, it may just be odd language, and that's absolutely true, we've all of a sudden had to go from absolutely not acceptable to how much, if you put it through an AI tester, how much is acceptable or not? It's become a really grey area, because the thing is, you as an academic, how much time are you willing to devote on this, you know, to get on top of this? People don't have time.
No, people don't have time, and they don't necessarily have the skills to be confident in how to assess it. And I'm just going to say it. We also, the AI testers are opaque. We don't know how accurate they are. They're commercial products provided to us. They may work. They may not work. I don't know whether they work or not. So my consumer protection hat says, I'm suspicious about a tool being sold by a commercial business that says, we think this is accurate, but you should reach your own judgment. I'm not capable of reaching my own judgment. I don't have the expertise to determine whether a piece is just awkward or passes over that collusion line. I think we're in a really difficult position. And the problem is, the one way we resolve this is going back to exams. In person, before someone, moderated exams. And that's everything that we've tried to move away from in a modern university, isn't it? You know, I've been an academic for many thousands of years, it seems now. and I come from a law faculty, and so we have, you know, professional accreditation requirements. And when I started, all exams were 3 hours, invigilated exams in a hall.
Yep.
And we know that that doesn't test students' knowledge. What it tests is your ability to write a good exam. Now, Is that a useful skill? I don't know. Nobody goes out into the world and now you're going to set a 3-hour exam. I mean, people go, oh, but if you have a client, you have to be able to respond to them quickly, or if you're in court, you have to be good on your feet. But exam's not testing either of those skills. And actually, the thing about working in the wide world is generally we're allowed to call on our colleagues to help us. I don't know the answer to this. I'll wander around to the person next door and go, do you know how you've done with one of these before? Let's get together. Very few workplaces do we work individually. We usually work in groups. So, you know, the individualated exam is not a reflection of the world we'll move into, and nor is it a good reflection of the learning that we hope has taken place with our students as they move through the university. But if we are worried about collusion, to my mind, that is the only form of assessment that overcomes the AI collusion problem, because you're not letting AI into the room. Now, there are reasons why we might not go down that path, but universities are having to have this conversation. Now, some faculties are doing really interesting things to avoid the issue or to manage the issue of AI in the classroom. So I know computer science is quite creative in the way they assess their students. They kind of go, well, students are going to use AI to code, so what we're going to do is replicate what they would do in a workforce with coding. And I'm probably putting words into their mouth, so this is my layperson's understanding. So we may give them code written by an AI and ask them to critique it, because what we know is that AI hallucinates, make mistakes. So human skill and knowledge is still really important in an AI world. We need students to be able to reflect critically on the outputs of the AI, even if they think they're going to use AI in what they do. So that's one response. You get the students to critique it. My daughter, I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning her, did data science at Monash, and she was asked to provide an oral explanation. They did random oral examinations of how they'd gone about a particular task. So she had to re-explain her thought process. And she, anyway, thought that was a very fair piece of assessment, because people code in different ways, but they should be able to explain how they reached a view on the architecture of what they'd created. So there's creative and imaginative ways to manage assessment. My point is simply the idea that we're going to be able to detect collusion and cheating, I think, is just fanciful. I think it's going to be a cat and mouse game. And so the conversations about what we think is at the core of what we do and how we can assess that in a way that's meaningful is the conversation we have to have. And universities aren't good at moving rapidly and changing quickly, but that's kind of where we are now. That's your point about we wrote a policy. Because, yes, 2 years ago, just before ChatGPT came onto the scheme, we're all worried about contract cheating. And I actually spoke at a conference of the, you know, academic integrity regulators on contract cheating and how we'd get over contract cheating, and we'd criminalise the people who offered contract cheating services. Contract cheating has almost been blown out of the water by the fact that now students, if they want to, can use an AI alternative. So the changes are so rapid. We as a university probably need to stop focusing on a sort of fixed model of risk identification and come up with something that's more dynamic and, in my mind, more substantive.
And indeed, plagiarism itself may have gone down because you don't need it anymore.
Don't need it anymore.
You just generate new stuff.
That's right. And in fact, plagiarism had already been going down even before we got generative AI in the form of ChatGPT, because there were lots of apps in the market about 2 years ago that were paraphrasing apps. I mean, plagiarism tools pick up plagiarism by looking for the same use of words or similar word patterns. So if you use a paraphrase app, you've avoided the application of the plagiarism tool. And the same with generative AI. To the extent that the AI detection tools are accurate, students can avoid the application of those tools by simply rewriting the output. So it's a cat and mouse game. We're all worried about scams, and we've been hearing endlessly about online scams and how difficult those are to combat because the scam keeps changing. Well, it's the same actually with AI collusion. It's rapidly changing. So we can't keep stopping it as a university. We probably need to sit back a little bit and think about what we do and how we do it.
If we look not at the students but at the teaching staff and how they can use AI to make their jobs easier, what are the ethics around that?
Oh, I think the ethics of staff using AI are also huge. And I go to the point, one, staff are busy. And so if we say, well, you can improve and you can be more efficient using AI, I would be saying, in what hour of the day do I find the time to learn to use the AI to be more efficient? Because it's another learning challenge for staff as well, to think about how they might incorporate it into their work practices. But equally, that transparency point is very important. I had some friends whose child went to a particular school, and they found out that the teachers were using AI to give feedback on essays that students had written. Now, students were in senior years, so it's not a, you know, year 7 essay. It was a year 11 essay, so it should be quite a polished piece. Now, I personally would be quite outraged if I found that a teacher was using an AI to give feedback on a piece of work that a student had submitted, because it seems the whole point about the teacher-student relationship in a school at that point in time when the student is perhaps studying literature, for example, which is usually, you know, a really intimate and fine-grained analysis of text between students, each other and staff, I'd be horrified to find AI was being used, particularly if I hadn't been told as a student or as a parent. And I think that transparency is important, and also that thought about, well, if we're going to use AI, where's appropriate to use it and where isn't? And giving feedback on students' work, at least substantive work, substantive written work, I think is a task that we at the moment expect to be done by a human with the skills and expertise genuinely to be able to respond to the piece of work.
So are we talking about AI literacy here? So many people talk about AI literacy and what do we mean by that? And also, for example, if that's going to be integrated into university curricula, what should we do?
I think we are talking about AI literacy. We've recently heard about the AI Act, which has been introduced in Europe, which is probably the most comprehensive effort to regulate AI rather than relying on codes of conduct or ethics or existing law. And one of the provisions in the AI Act says that people who are deploying AI are responsible for training their staff about the use of the AI. And I love that provision. I think it's really important. I think that, you know, we can put up lots of rules about how AI can be used, where it can be used, but we need to train staff. And that's AI literacy, because it's only by understanding how the technology works that people are able to have those sort of reflective conversations about where it can be used, how it can be used, what it can be used on. And I like technology, so I'm not saying people shouldn't use it. I'm saying people should be enabled to be able to use the technology and then reflect on where the technology is useful for them and where it isn't.
So one of the issues you mentioned briefly, and that is about privacy and breach of privacy. I mean, what happens in all of this and how relevant is it to students in universities? What rights do we have?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? What rights do students have to privacy in relation to the data that's collected about them by the university? I constantly hear that young people today, so that's anybody younger than whoever's speaking, don't care about privacy because they use social media widely. I'm not sure that young people use social media widely, actually. I haven't seen data on that. I think as an academic, I'd simply be saying we shouldn't make assumptions about what people use, how they use it, and what their views about privacy are without asking them. We can't assume from people's use of particular social media tools that they don't care about privacy. They may have different understandings of privacy, and they may also have their own ways of protecting their privacy online. But I think privacy is really important, and I think it's really important for ways that we kind of go, privacy is important, but then go, oh, but, you know, whatever, we've kind of given that away, or we actually want to live in a safe society, or we like being interconnected. Privacy is important in its own right, because privacy is saying I have the integrity as an individual to manage my own life without information about how I do that being shared and replicated. But privacy is also important for instrumental reasons, because privacy is important to other important rights, like the right to freedom of expression, the right to freedom of association. Those things also require a baseline of privacy. If we think that we're being surveilled when we're in public spaces, there's a chilling effect on who we associate with and what we do in those public spaces. And if we think our expressions, our statements about ourselves and what we believe in are going to be monitored and collected and analysed, then there's a chilling effect on what we feel able to speak up about and say. So I think privacy is really important. At the moment, Australia is looking at reforming its Privacy Act to bring it into line with the digital age. People probably aren't that interested in the technical niceties of the Privacy Act, but I'd just say the Privacy Act reforms are really, really important. And they're a way of keeping AI in check, because AI relies on data. So if we give people more control over data, and if we say there are more responsibilities on the companies that are collecting and processing data, then that actually does something to the AI that is trained on the data down the track.
So at the moment, if you type a prompt or you put data into something like ChatGPT, who owns it?
Well, nobody owns it because you don't actually own, you don't own statements. But if you put information into ChatGPT, it doesn't automatically flow into the outputs. And ChatGPT is creative. It creates output, but it's not adaptive in the sense that it's constantly feeding on the data. Every so often they update the underlying model. They may or may not use prompts as a way of improving the output. Certainly in your interactions with generative AI, the more you prompt it, the better responses you get. But that's because that's the way the tool works. It's a statistical use of language. So your prompts are sort of guiding that statistical output in a particular direction. That doesn't mean that becomes training data for the underlying GPT model. When they do those regular updates, if you're using the free version of ChatGPT, those prompts, the information you put in, may well become part of the next lot of training data that goes into it. If you get the paid version, you have an option of saying, I don't want my information, the information I put into this tool, used as training data. So if you pay for privacy, is typically the model. It's the same with social media, right? It's free.
You are the product.
But we are the product. So if you pay, you get more privacy.
So, is it okay for staff, academics, to use AI to mark students' work?
I think it depends on the assessment, because we're already marking students' work automatically. If we use quizzes, for example, that's marked automatically. Just a note on quizzes, I think generative AI may have blown quizzes out of the water because students can get a response really quickly. I mean, they often could before, but now even more so. So we already were automating the marking of some work. One of the possible uses of AI in the university that's being proposed is to give students feedback on formative assessment or even perhaps drafts. I personally am uncomfortable with the use of AI for giving feedback, except maybe you could use it on a draft piece of work to give students feedback on their style of writing or their English. But given we know so little about the accuracy of AI and giving a response to any prompt, given we have no certainty about when that inaccuracy will occur, so it can give a wrong response and we don't know how often or when it will give that wrong response, I'm uncomfortable with using AI to assess students' work or give feedback on students' work. I think that that is part of a relationship between staff and students. But I understand that students want more feedback, are constantly asking for feedback. So perhaps there's a way to do that at an early stage. But it comes back to this point about being really aware of what the tool can do and what it can't do. AI literacy, so we know where it's appropriate to use it. We're absolutely transparent with students and how we're using it. We're using it at a stage where the stakes aren't too high for students or us, the staff. Then it might be useful.
For teaching staff, if it's not for assessment, what about using AI for other purposes? For example, the designing a class, a lesson plan, or generating some images for your slides to make it more appealing and attractive?
Well, lots of staff are using DALL-E or any of the image generating software to create great images in their slides. I don't have a problem with that.
Well, that's new for me. I've got a DALL-E. I've got to follow that one up. I need new images.
You know, that's quite fun. But I don't think staff should be using AI for anything we wouldn't let students do. So if I'm using AI to do my lesson planning or write my lectures, I should be disclosing that to students that this is what I've done. We as staff need to have the same standards for ourselves as we do for students. So we need to disclose it. And if we think it's okay for a lecture, I don't think anybody is writing their lecture using AI. So I'm just saying I do not think anybody's doing this. But if I was, then I'd have to be saying to my students, you can write your assessment using it. I mean, you know, it works both ways.
Why is there parity? Why do we assume, I mean, we're not being assessed on them. Why would we be held to the same principles? I mean, it's a different relationship, surely.
Well, because I think that as an academic, I'm modelling the conduct and the approach that I want my students to adopt. I mean, I teach law, and I guess one of the things that I would say about law is the skill that I'm teaching is structuring arguments, applying an inquiring approach, drawing on the parameters of the law to the scenarios that are presented to me. I think that requires quite a degree of human judgment and creativity. And so what I'm doing in class is modelling that judgment that creativity, that rigor for my students, and often I fail abysmally and they correct me. I think it's really important that if I think that's what's special about my discipline, that I am in fact demonstrating that to students.
So what's your view about academics using AI for research, for getting papers ready?
Well, it's controversial. So the role of AI in getting papers ready is very similar to the role of AI in students doing assessments. So I would like to think that we as academics can use tools to polish our writing, polish our spelling. But a lot of journals ask for that to be disclosed. And there are reports of academics who have used, say, a Grammarly tool or another tool to polish their writing, who've then been told that the journal won't accept their work. So it's kind of the same for students. You've got to disclose what you're doing, but also check what the journal that you might be writing for wants. I tend to think that using AI to polish work is very different from using AI to create an article by asking the AI to provide a framework or to draft an outline or to draft parts of it. Certainly using AI to create evidence or results is absolutely improper. So you've sort of got a sliding scale of what's possible. I guess some people talk about AI as the first draft tool. I talk about AI as the refine your work tool. That's my personal experience with it. But again, academic writing is still working that out. Because I'm a lawyer, I'm very rule compliant, so I won't now use Grammarly in my work because I don't want to run into problems with breaking the rules. But I think that's also a bit of a shame, right?
The other issue that we have, you know, I'm a language academic. When students submit work and you think, this language, you know, in Italian, you cannot be at this level. The level of expression in this text is just not possible. You don't know this. You've done 3 semesters of Italian. Apart from anything else, these expressions are things that native speakers wouldn't do or would use very sparingly, or they'd have to be highly educated. What do you do in those cases?
The example you've given is a really good example of the dilemma for academics, because you, using your expert specialist knowledge, have looked at a piece of work and determined, no doubtly correctly, this must have been produced using some AI tool, because it's not something that a student could create and it's not something that a native speaker would actually produce. The dilemma is your judgment may not be the standard that's required for a misconduct hearing. And so we're left in this grey area of saying to the student, I don't think this is your work. And the student then has a choice about how they respond. And I would suggest that the ethical student would be embarrassed and apologise and realise that they have transgressed the requirements of the university. But there'll be students that will try and, you know, bluff their way through it and saying, who are you to criticise my work? I just happen to be particularly gifted. So it's a dilemma for universities. Mm. And the only way around that is to say you've got to do your assessment in here, in person, or some other creative option. All right, this is your work. Let's sit down and have a chat about it. But all of this, and I've been talking about, you know, academic integrity and the role of the academic and the relationship with the student and the thought they need to have, all of that assumes academics have time to do this. And as academics are increasingly expected to teach more students, to engage with more different kinds of disciplinary requirements, to gain more expertise, we've got to be really careful about responsibilising the academic. You mentioned that earlier. The academic as an individual can't deal with all of these problems alone. It has to be an institutional response. And I think academic workload is really important here. And that's why we also need to talk about institutional responses and indeed, you know, national responses. Ideally, these conversations actually just make us better teachers, but we are under pressure from increased student numbers, reduction in staff, you know, increases in the amount of assessment that have to be done. All of these things, you know, kind of work against the sort of creative, engaged approach to staff-student interactions and research and course design that we're talking about. So I quite agree, we always need to be careful. Our presumption of innocence is quite important. But we can also do things like tell students ahead of time that if we have questions about your work, that we will bring you in and ask you to talk about your work. And that's fair on students because they know that they may be asked to explain their work. But it's also kind of a flag which says, you know, we are looking at the work critically. I think engaging students in this conversation about what our expectations are is really important, and engaging students in what we do when we think the work's not their own is really important.
Well, now this comes back to another point you made and kind of sticks in the gall of academics, and I pointed to it beforehand, is that the student is given the benefit of the doubt. in most cases that we find, which actually doesn't resolve the problem at all. I mean, how do we get around that? What are the implications of that?
I mean, at the moment, I think the standards are really unclear, to be honest. If we can't prove they've transgressed the standards we've set for them, then actually we do need to give them the benefit of the doubt. They're students. There's a power differential. We can't accuse students and, you know, of things that we can't prove they've done when that has a tremendous impact on their lives and their futures. And I'm always aware of the sort of inequalities of resources and ability to defend claims between students that may come from very articulate, feisty households and students who perhaps don't. And we all know that sort of confirmation bias. If you tell me I've done something, I might agree with you. I'm always concerned about that. So I think if we think there's a problem of collusion or cheating or whatever, and we think that we can't actually act against students, then the answer is we ourselves need to change our practices. If we think that we have a problem with this work that students producing doesn't have integrity or isn't replicating the skills, expertise, inquiry that we want to be having within the university, then we need to reflect on our assessment packages, our assessment approaches, and change those and move to something that we think does have more integrity and does produce the responses that we want. Now, I know that's easy to say and really hard to do, and I know that is a resource question, but it's kind of like existential question for universities, isn't it? We are places of higher education. We're supposed to be complying and aspiring to the standards that are commensurate with being a place of higher education. And so I think we do need to take that seriously, and cat and mouse whack-a-mole game is not going to work here. I think that local content and bias are actually not always the same question. So all AI will be biased because it's statistical, it's reflecting the world that it's come from, not the world we aspire to have. Most AI will be American-centric because that's where the models we're using are trained. Now, we can refine those models in Australia to make them more locally resonant. Whether we should be creating our own Australian models, large language models, I actually doubt. They're really expensive to create. Why would we spend time and resources creating our own models for something we don't really know is that useful at the moment? Because actually we don't really know that that's useful. It's good at pictures, it's good at poems, can polish a piece of work, it can provide a draft. That's actually pretty low-level stuff, notwithstanding concerns about it. It's very difficult to fix bias mathematically because the whole point of a statistical machine learning tool is to find the patterns in the data, which is effectively find the biases in the data. You can take out the material you think is causing unacceptable levels of bias or discriminatory outputs, but the more you take out of the model, the less accurate it becomes. So if you try and correct and say the outputs of the tool must be representative of society, you sometimes get these really morally, ethically, socially awkward responses. We go, whoa, that's not the representation we want. And so I actually think these are human questions. And I think these are exactly why we need AI literacy, because we need to deconstruct AI to say, well, what does this output tell us about the society we live in, and what does it tell us about the society we want to have?
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guest, Professor Jeannie Patterson, Director of the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics at the University of Melbourne. Producers for this episode were Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Parham of ProFactual, and Gavin Naber. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studios by Gavin Naber and is a podcast from the University of Melbourne School of Languages and Linguistics. This episode was produced with some limited use of generative AI technologies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons Copyright 2024, The University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hadjick, and thank you for joining us.